You're tuned to North Fork Works, and I'm Hazel Kahn. My guest today is Eve Kaplan-Warbrecht, owner and farmer of Garden of Eve Organic Farm in Riverhead, New York. It's been decades, actually 2 decades, I think, since we last talked, when we were both members of the NFEC, North Fork Environmental Council Board, which actually seemed to be rather nice. It's rather good old days now to me in some ways, but welcome to North Fork Works. Very nice to see you again.
Thank you.
Let's start with your life as a farmer.
I was staff for the North Fork Environmental Council, and you were on the board. I was a Riverhead coordinator, so I was involved in advocacy for farmland preservation, open space preservation, and other environmental issues in Riverhead and on the North Fork. I was there for 3 years. And at that time, my husband and I were already starting our farm. Shortly after we met, we started a large garden in Riverhead on about 1 acre of land. And we ended up with a lot of zucchini, a lot of extra zucchini. And as anybody who gardens knows, you know, when you have a few zucchini, you have a lot of zucchini. So one of the other board members actually was one of the organizers of the Greenport Farmers Market. And I had brought zucchini in to give away at the office. And she said, oh, you know, do you want to come down and sell at our farmers market? Because she needed more farmers. So we did. And the very first one, we made $40. It was inside the old carousel building. And we spent our whole $40 on the way home, but we were hooked and grew it from there. So
you had this 1 acre and you already considered yourselves farmers on this 1 acre.
Well, that's what's funny, because it was actually our first year really gardening. And, you know, we already managed to start selling things that year. So we considered that our first year, even though it was year zero. So we're both really interested in, you know, being entrepreneurs and going off on our own and being part of the farming community out here, which is really a great community and really great to be part of. If you're gonna live in a rural area, it seemed like what else would you do besides be a part of the farm community? I had the job, and then my husband also had a job as well. He had worked for Citizens Campaign for the Environment, which is another not-for-profit advocacy group based on Long Island. He did a lot of work with clean water advocacy and sewer overflows. And then the second year that we farmed, he left that job. So he was farming full time in the summer, and then he did building in the winter. So he worked for Environment East and some other builders, you know, doing roofing, carpentry, stuff like that. Yeah, we just grew it from there. So the second year, we each did a different farmers market on the weekends. So we had 2 different farmers markets, Port Washington and Locust Valley. He started up with New York City Green Market.
More than just zucchini then.
Yes, more than zucchini, exactly. But, you know, it takes you a little while. There's a big learning curve for sure. But we had all the different vegetables and then grew it pretty quickly from that 1 acre to, you know, 3 acres, then 5, then 10, then 15. So that land was in my family since the 70s, and it had been farmed by another farmer who had rented it, but he retired right around that same time.
Your family was, they were here on?
Not really. When I was a kid, you know, we would come out in the summer, and I always wanted to live out here full time, and now I do, so.
Where were you actually born then?
In New Jersey.
I see. Initial 1 acre, it was on this, on your family farm?
Mm-hmm.
Was the rest of it being farmed?
Yeah, it was being farmed by the Brezhne family. Mm-hmm. He had also a mixed vegetable farm, and he had one of the first farm stands on the North Fork that he started, you know, selling direct to people driving by on the road, and had it right up on Sound Avenue before Sound Avenue had a lot of traffic and people would just pull over by the side of the road and get his vegetables. Yeah. So we kind of modeled it after him and the success that he had had.
So after 20 years, what kind of farm is it? What do you sell most of?
Making it financially sustainable was very important to us. We didn't really want to be hobby farmers. We didn't want to be subsidizing the farm. It's such hard work that if it's not supporting you, it really isn't sustainable for you to work that hard and be working another job and putting all your money into the farm so that you can lose it. You know, the financial side of it is fairly complicated. It's not an easy business at all. You know, farmers are price takers, not price makers. And people really don't value food in this country, so it's pretty frustrating overall in that respect. You know, as much as you may love the work, and people say they love farmers and it's the number one trusted and respected profession, it's not the number one pocketbook respected. So You know, people are happy to spend whatever per month for their gym membership or their Apple storage or whatever luxuries that they need. But if your tomato is $3 or something, forget it. You know, they're just going to give you a dirty look. See, this country has a long history starting around World War II and a little bit before of making it a priority to have cheap food, that it's national policy that food should be cheap, that people should not have to spend a lot of money on food. So somehow it's become part of our culture that it's the one thing that people feel like they can control in their budget. That really hurts the farmer. On Long Island, we're farming in one of the most expensive places in the United States, and we can't control most of those expenses. You know, minimum wage just went up 30% in the last 5 or 6 years, but can we raise our food prices 30%? Not really, no.
In Europe, you think there's a different attitude about what proportion of one's household income should be spent on food?
And that is a fact. Americans spend 10% or less of their budget on food. I think Europeans, it's at least 20%. And most European farms are heavily subsidized by the government. So it is a public policy priority for them to keep small farms farming, to keep generational farms existing and heirloom products, heritage processes, you know. But it is a priority for the government, and the people of that region want to keep those farms there. So they're willing to put the tax dollars towards those farms so that those people can make it. And we don't get anything from the government in this country.
Back to Garden of Eve again.
So we've been certified organic since the beginning. You know, if you're a new farmer starting out, it's really not more work to be organic than to be spraying toxic chemicals. Because when you take on all those chemicals, first of all, they're very expensive. Second of all, they're heavily regulated. So you have to take classes, you have to get licenses, you have to have special storage facilities and all those things. To be organic, you don't have to deal with any of that. And not dealing with toxics, you're not spraying it on yourself, you're not eating it. You don't have to. We were certified organic from the very beginning, and we have been ever since. I mean, we have to pay for the certification. For the last, I would say, 10 years or so, there's been cost share. So we do get about half of it back.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To carry out the farming doesn't necessarily cost more money because we're certified than we're not. You know, I mean, the organic brand is very important because it gave farmers who farm without chemicals legitimacy in the marketplace, and it gave consumers a way to identify that produce and to support it. And that's what we've seen. We've seen huge, tremendous growth in organic purchasing. Actually, the organic certification was created, you know, in legislation in 1998. It's managed by the USDA. Right. And then the National Organic Program is staff who are part of USDA. But the board, they're uncompensated.
I see. Even if it says it's organic.
No. And you can't say it's organic if you're not an organic seal on it, or it doesn't. But if it says organic, it means it's certified organic and it's gone through a third-party inspection process with governmental standards.
So all your things are actually labeled then?
Whatever we're required to label is labeled. We use the organic seal and we have our organic certificate at our booth at the farmer's market. You can ask them, are you certified organic?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if they're not, they shouldn't be using the word organic. You know, I mean, with all due respect, there's a lot of farmers, but there's also a lot of businesses that kind of greenwash, and they like to use the word organic, but they're not actually following.
Well, that's what I'm talking
perhaps
about.
Following organic standards. I mean, in the store, if it is, then it's certified organic. If you're at a farm, or people say, oh, we're like organic, or we use organic practices, you can say, are you certified organic? That's all. It's not that complicated. There are some types of agriculture that are very difficult to do certified organic, and there are certain places in the country where it's very difficult to raise certain types of crop certified organic. For example, on Long Island, almost every wine grape is sprayed with fungicide. It's very wet here. It's very humid in the summer, and we have a lot of rain in the fall. So that's the reality of that industry. If you want to make money and you don't want all your grapes to die, people are using chemicals to meet that goal. In other places where it's much drier, like California, there's a lot more organic wine, organic grapes. They're able to do it because of the climate. But there's almost no commercial organic tree fruit grown in the Northeast. Because again, it's very humid and we have a lot of rain. All the apples in the store are all coming from Washington and Oregon.
And then on here because
you would lose so much fruit to rot that it might not even be a commercially successful harvest. You wouldn't have enough fruit to sell to pay your bills. Honestly, because people are really picky too. I mean, if people were willing to accept cosmetic blemishes, then organic is fairly viable. In the Northeast, there's definitely some, you know, farms or people do it for themselves in their backyard. You know, the pests get on them and there's fungal issues and, you know, they're not perfect and people want perfect food because that's what they're used to.
You think that's an American thing too? It's not like that in Europe?
Yeah, because the more you lose touch with farming and you lose touch with food production, if you grow your own food, you know, I had this apple tree in my backyard. I picked the apple. I know it's good, right? Like, I grew it. It's behind my house. It's got little spots on it. Oh, that's okay. Hey, you're not going to throw it away, right? It's your apple that you grew in your backyard. But if you don't have any apples, you don't have any friends with apple trees, you've never seen an apple tree, all you know is you go to the store, the apple's red, it's perfect, it's shiny. And you see one, not perfect, not shiny. Are you going to eat that? No. You're going to say, I don't know what's wrong with that one because you don't know why it's like that.
I wonder how much attitudes are changing about that.
I mean, there's a little bit of a trend right now, but I don't think it's anything to really like move the needle. The number one source of food waste is actually commercial processing because so much blemished food that just gets diverted because of the appearance is not saleable.
You've been a member of OFA, the Organic Farmers Association, for a few years, and recently you were elected to serve as a Northeast Region Farmer representative.
Right.
And in that capacity, you and other members of your group went down to Washington to meet with legislators. Can you talk about what you did there and what was the outcome?
Sure. Well, I joined the board of the Organic Farmers Association during COVID. So all the meetings were remote. People were doing kind of Zoom lobbying, which last year was the first year that after COVID that they got back to doing a fly-in. As organic really gained a lot of traction and a lot of consumer dollars, the big food companies started taking interest. And by acquiring these smaller organic companies, it was a way for them to show their stockholders that they were growing their market share. Organic, it's one of the fastest growing sectors. So these companies started getting bought by, you know, Kraft and Kellogg's and Unilever, biggest multinational companies, wanted to hold organic brands. And as they did that, the sourcing and the conscience of it really has been lost in a lot of ways. You know, say even Stonyfield, they still do have contracts with Northeast Dairies, and they also get milk from some very large, what we would call like CAFO, like confined animal feedlot operations, you know, in other parts of the country. Some of the organic cereal brands, they're using imported Chinese or Indian organic grain, which may or may not have fraud issues and stuff like that.
Organically speaking.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. That was troubling to me. You know, when you buy organic, you want the product and you want to eat it because you like how it tastes. You know, you also think that you're supporting, you know, something positive. Really, Organic Farmers Association, in a lot of ways, is the first national organization started by farmers, run by farmers, to work on national policy for organic. Because there's a lot of trade groups, a lot of big companies. They've got full-time lobbyists, and they're in Washington every day of every year, you know, meeting with people, making their wishes known. So at least we're in Washington a couple of days a year. So we're not there all year, but at least we're doing something.
It is a regular thing you do?
This was the second year that I went. I don't know that I'll go every year, but someone will go every year, right? And at least I'll feel like I'm being represented.
So OFA started when?
I think it was 2016. Fairly new. Fairly recent.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Riverhead farmer Eve Kaplan-Warbrecht is talking about her farm, Garden of Eve. This is Hazel Kahn and Norfolk Works on WPKN Radio.
So Organic Farmers Association, we have a policy staff person. So she's able to track organic laws and regulations that are going to affect organic farmers. And we have a whole policy process. The policy committee, any member can make a suggestion of a policy that they would like to see the organization take. That committee discusses all the suggestions, adopts a platform that gets circulated to the whole membership. You vote. That becomes the policy slate for the year. So she is working with and informing us about the way legislation and regulations are going through mainly Congress, a little bit through USDA and through the National Organic Program as well. A lot of it's through the Agriculture Committee in Congress, letting letting us know what we need to say, who we need to meet with, helping set up those meetings.
One person is doing all of that?
Yes.
She's a paid employee.
Yeah, so she's able to really stay tuned into that process. So when they do the fly-in, you had a meeting with Representative LaLota's office, Chuck Schumer's office, and Kristen Gillibrand. There are three representatives right now. We talked to them about what our priorities are and asked them to support legislation that supports organic farmers.
Anything more specific you can say about what you are asking to support?
In this Congress, it's a little bit complicated because they're not doing a whole lot to fight with each other, but eventually they will adopt a farm bill. So farm bill is really farm money. It's a huge amount of money. And basically you're asking them to allocate money that benefits small farmers rather than just big farmers or GMO corn subsidies for the Midwest or whatever. We want them to help fund organic research. For example, even locally, our Cornell Cooperative Extension, the Long Island Research Center, they have an organic trial block. And they do quite a bit of research, so they get some of that money and that funds their researchers to do research on organic, which helps us because then when we have a problem, you know, they can say, oh, well, we tried these organic sprays and this is the one that works best. And, oh, we grew these tomatoes organically and this is the variety that worked best. So, you know, that's very helpful. We're asking them to recognize organic farming as climate smart farming because there's a lot of discussion about giving financial incentives for climate smart farming, and we're already doing that. So here they're trying to change all these other farmers to become more climate smart, and we're already doing that. We're already cover cropping. There's a lot of no-till. We're retaining water. You know, a lot of those conservation practices we're already using. We're asking them to give some money for researchers to develop seeds and breeds of livestock that do best under organic management, because when you're using a lot of chemicals, it's not the same as something that has to thrive with less nitrogen and, you know, has to be more independently pest resistant. You know, the dairy industry has been in really, really tough times for quite a while since the 80s, but it just gets harder and harder.
Why is that? Can you say anything a bit more?
Well, that would be like another hour. You should have a dairy farmer on your program.
Yeah.
And ask them.
Okay.
But we support organic dairy, so asking the farm bill to this point even just collect statistics from organic farmers, dairy farmers, so that they can get some price protections for their milk. The price of milk is heavily regulated in a way that other foods are not. When their costs go up, they're not even allowed to charge more for their milk. So a lot of the time they're forced by law to sell the milk for less than what it's actually costing them to produce
it. Really? I did not know that.
Yeah, which is why so many dairies are always going out of business, and there's just incredible consolidation in the dairy industry.
It's going to supermarkets. There seem to be so many brands of milk.
They're just brands, you know, it's just a brand. But the milk itself is mainly coming from very large industrial dairies. I don't even know how much of that is coming from New York, from the Northeast. Like, the biggest dairies are out west, where they have no water. It makes no sense. And, you know, they ship it all over the country. So those are some of the things that we were in Washington talking.
What were you most pleased with what you achieved down there?
I appreciated getting the meeting with LaLota's office. Staffer that I met with was not very knowledgeable about agriculture. The reality is farmers are a very small percentage of his electorate, and most of the voters care a little bit about farming, but not a whole lot. It's not at the top of their list. So I don't expect him to be an expert on these issues.
It's also a very large district. Sparsely.
Well, exactly why it's even more important for us to go in there and meet with him. So, you know, really, I just wanted to inform them how many organic farmers there are in the district, and that it's an issue that consumers really care about. Mm. There are a lot of well-educated voters in the district. I'm sure it's a higher than average percentage that buy organic products.
Yeah.
You know, they want to see legislation that supports small organic farmers. So just letting him know that's a constituency in his district.
And you felt good about the meeting?
Yeah, he's a relatively new congressman. So a lot of the decision-making falls to the more senior people. Mark Molinaro is from Central New York, and he is one of the leaders in agricultural policy, so they kind of defer to him. Kristen Gillibrand is on the Agriculture Committee, so she's important, and Schumer, obviously, is very important right now in Congress, and they've been very supportive. We were also able to meet with the undersecretary for the National Organic Program. It's important for them to see small and medium-sized organic farmers are united and that we have a voice and that we're coming to Washington. Just remind them that we're here and that we're watching the process.
On the North Fork, you don't need to persuade people. There is a high level of awareness.
There is, but what you said to me earlier is exactly what everyone says. Chemical farmers deliberately try to confuse the issue. Sometimes at farmers markets, we hear chemical farmers say, we're as close to organic as you can get without being certified. And what they actually mean is, we do whatever we want. We use chemicals. But we feel like we have integrity, and we don't want you to question us about what we're doing because we don't think there's anything wrong with it. So as organic became more popular, the backlash was organic doesn't matter, local is most important. And they're really two completely different things.
Yes.
It is important to support your local farmers, absolutely. And don't kid yourself that there's not a lot of chemicals on that produce.
Most of the listeners are probably in Connecticut.
Okay.
Is there anything you can say to them over there?
Yeah, Connecticut's got a tremendous number of small farmers and community-supported agriculture farmers with farm shares, and you should support them. It really makes those farms possible, and if people don't support them, then they will not exist. The farmland will not continue to exist. It'll be developed. The only way that you keep farmers farming is by buying our products. Like, we're not asking for donations. And we don't get government handouts. We just want you to buy our produce. And it tastes better, it looks better, and you enjoy the benefits of having farmland near you.
Good that you made that connection with keeping the land undeveloped by construction. That argument is actually not very often made.
Right. People think that they can continue enjoying the view, but they don't have to buy the produce.
Yeah.
I'll shop at the supermarket, but don't let that farmer develop their land.
I don't know that a lot of people really understand what CSAs are.
Community-supported agriculture has been around for quite a while. Basically, it's a farm share, like a weekly veggie box, and it's like a subscription. So you sign up. Now is our sign-up season between now and June, and then people get vegetables from June through November. Different farms have slightly different, you know, lengths of the season. Ours, for example, is 24 weeks, so it's basically 6 months. It helps you because now you have vegetables in your fridge. You don't have to go to the store and buy the same thing every single week. You're getting what's in season. So it's really fresh. It's ripened on the vine. It's nutrient dense. It's got its good bacteria. People find themselves learning to cook new things and being more creative. And
by default, you're experimenting because those are vegetables you may not have bought before.
Yeah, and it benefits the farm because people pay before the season starts so that right now is when we have all our bills. We're buying seeds, we're buying equipment, insurance due, and we've got all our staff coming. We're in the middle of March, so we've got like 3 months of payroll before the first tomato even comes in. So it helps with all those bills, the reliability of it, that you're willing to support us over that amount of time, and the community. You know, you get to visit the farm, you can form a relationship with the farmer, sometimes with other members. You know, there's different events for CSA members, like we'll have open houses and...
Well, it's community-supported agriculture.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
That's what it stands for.
Yeah.
Mm. Talking about labor, are you able to staff the way you want to? Or are you having labor problems?
It was really hard for a really long time. Now we go through the H-2A program, which is a guest worker agricultural visa program.
And where do they come from?
This year we'll have people from Mexico, South Africa, and El Salvador. Yeah, we provide housing. Now we only have 4 H-2A coming this year for us. Well, now we're not running our farm market anymore. So yeah, we'll just have 7.
That's 7, it. And that's your peak
yeah, for like,
number.
For like 40 acres, yeah. We'd like to have more, but we can't afford it. You know, I started the farm market in 2004 when my son was born. I grew it and grew it and grew it, and it was a lot of fun. We did a lot of events, a lot of UPIC, and, you know, I love educating people about farming and bringing them to the farm. That really drove me, and, you know, we had the Long Island Garlic Festival for 20 years. You know, we'd have like 20,000 people a year visit the farm. Everything has a season. My son went to college this year, and I was really interested in moving on to some other interests and not being in retail for the rest of my life. You know, it's a ton of responsibility. We were 7 days a week for 8 months a year, and every weekend, every holiday is your busiest day. So, you know, last year I had kind of my first Mother's Day in like 20 years that wasn't a public Mother's Day. You know, it was my least favorite holiday because it was always the busiest day at the farm and we always had so much to plan for.
You were on such a strategic location. Mm-hmm. Everybody who's coming from Riverhead and turning east sees it at that corner. People know about it, but I think a lot of people are not exactly clear.
Just leased it to them. And our farm is still there, so we're still running the farm just like we did. We still have our farm share program and mm-hmm. people pick up at the farm and we do farmers markets in New York City. And they're running the farm market. They run agritourism. They're going to have a tulip festival in a little while. It's like three brothers that are running.
And the name is Water Drinker?
Yeah, Water Drinker. Yeah, so they have an operation in Manorville, and then this is their second. It's mainly agritourism, and they'll have sunflowers and pumpkins.
Yeah, I think people, when they first heard about it, mm-hmm. and I'm just talking as a resident of the North Fork, the first thing is, oh my God, there'll be more traffic. Mm-hmm. Now, all of that apple-picking traffic is going to come.
They'd be happy if there's traffic, then they're supporting farmers, because if there wasn't any traffic, the farmers wouldn't be left. So, and I mean, how many days a year really is it? I mean, the farmers have to put up with more traffic from second homeowners when mm-hmm. we're trying to get around. You know, we have plenty of complaints. Like if all the second homeowners weren't out here, then we would have no trouble getting around. And that's 365 days a year, not just, you know, in the fall or whatever.
But a lot of the time people don't hear the side of the argument.
Right.
And so I'm happy that, you know, that you're telling the listeners what they do need to hear.
The thing I really appreciated about going to Washington with Organic Farmers Association was, you know, it's very empowering. It's a good feeling to feel like I'm actually taking action. And, you know, I'm there, I'm talking to the representatives. You know, we are a small industry in number. We don't have a lot of big money, sadly, to be hiring lobbyists and to be in Washington all the time. But at least we're there, you know, making our voices heard. Well, if people want to support farmers and they want to support organic, you know, you really need to put your dollar where your mouth is. You really need to support the product and look for the certified organic and look for small farmer labels. You know, I always try to buy a farmer's market. That's how you know you're buying from a small farmer.
And of course, there's farm stands as well.
Yeah, and farm stands, absolutely. Yeah, whenever you can buy direct, you're cutting out the middleman. You're putting most of your dollar in the farmer's pocket. You know, we save land, we save water, we're good for the climate. And there's agritourism, families get together, reconnect with agriculture. It's a livelihood. You know, it's supported my husband and I for the past 20 years. It's very hard work. It's not something most people are cut out for or able to do. It can be very monotonous and you're outside in the cold, the heat, you know, monotonous, repeated physical labor to doing all your bookkeeping and, you know, marketing and everything else. So support your farmer, you know, if it costs you an extra couple of cents or a dollar, like, it's really worth it.
As we end, please tell our listeners how they can find out more about you, Garden of Eve, and OFA.
Our farm is Garden of Eve Farm, and we have our website is gardenofevefarm.com. We have a lot of information on there, our community-supported agriculture and farm share program. If you are on Long Island, we have pickups at the farm, and we also do home delivery all through Suffolk County and Eastern Nassau, and we are signing people up now for our upcoming season.
Home deliveries of the CSA, you
mean? Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, weekly and bi-weekly, vegetables, fruit, flowers, and eggs. The Organic Farmers Association at organicfarmersassociation.org. That's a nonprofit organization, so people can join as members, make donations, and all those things.
Thank you very much, Eve Kaplan-Warbrecht, owner and farmer of Garden of Eve Farm. Eve, it was very, very nice to see you. Very nice to see a big thing that you've been doing since I last saw you. Very big thing. So thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you for having
me. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Riverhead farmer Eve Kaplan-Warbrecht talking about her Garden of Eve Farm and her advocacy work for organic farmers. You can hear North Fork Works on the first Wednesday of the month at this time and any time at all as podcasts on hazelkahn.com. And please remember that just as you can help your organic farmer with a CSA subscription, you can help your radio station by becoming a WPKN sustaining donor. Thank you very much. I'm Hazel Kahn.